Morning and welcome to everyone. I'll start with the gentleman on my left hand side here, who's Paul Morisa. He's the project director. He was previously the regional head of Gauteng. He's acting as project director at the moment. And he's going to be giving the presentation from the chapter 7 up to chapter 11. And as for me, I'm Advocate Mokhatla. I am the acting head of SIU. And I also hold the position of Deputy National Director, NDA, here of Legal Affairs. On my right hand side is Roland Dolosi. He is a head of strategy. And behind him is Jerome Wells, Advocate Jerome Wells. He is the regional head, acting regional head, Western Cape. And in the middle is Ms. Zeria Nyati. She is head of business support. On her left-hand side is Advocate Gerard Fisagi, the head of legal. I wanted to say legal affairs. The lead corporate counsel. Lead corporate counsel, aside. Behind him, that's Gus Elliott, the chief financial officer based in Istanbul. Next to him, that is Zodwa Kesipe. She is the acting regional head for Gauteng at the moment, also coordinator for the Limpopo intervention. And right next to her, it's Mr. Boyen Dala, who is the acting head of communications at the moment. That's the chief. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Hollywood, how many actings are we here?
Four.
Okay.
Soon it's not going to be acting anymore. The recruitment process is up and the panels will be set up, the interviews are going on for some of the positions.
Right, we're in your hands.
Thank you. I will start with chapter 1 to chapter 6. Talking about the background of SIU, the mandate, and the strategy overview. As a background, it started as a Heath Commission, and then the SIU was established. And then SIU is now termed Schedule 3A public institution in terms of the public information management. The mandate of the SIU is to investigate corruption and maladministration, and we do that by doing forensic investigation, and also have the wing where we do civil litigation that emanates from the investigation. The SIU gets its work paid brief as a proclamation from the president. We use the civil law to fight the corruption, and we litigate in cases where there should be civil coverage or where we're setting aside contracts that were irregularly awarded. And this is done in the special tribunal court and in the courts of the country. The strategy overview, our vision, we want to work together with every institution and organization to create a society of corruption. Our mission is that we will fight corruption through quality investigation and quality litigation. We will talk more about this quality litigation at a later stage. Our values are integrity, cooperation, professionalism, and that drive to make sure that we are effective and make sure that everyone feels empowered to work. The strategic positioning of SIU, it has positioned itself towards delivering forensic services and enabling solutions that support good governance, integrity of government business systems, compliance and law enforcement. We are aligned to the bigger government outcome 3, where it says that all people in South Africa should feel safe. Outcome 12, that efficient, effective, and development of oriented public service and empowered, fair, and inclusive citizenship. The strategic objective is to increase the impact of the SIU's forensic services in the public sector by completing investigations successfully, which will be explained a little bit about what we mean by successfully. The strategic drivers, there is a, we call it the Stonehenge, the graph there, it shows various categories. The first quadrant there on the left-hand side, more, where we will then give systematic recommendations and the report will go to Treasury, which will then in turn be able to issue out minutes that are going to be recommendations or even fostered into the rules and regulations to enable government departments to be able to get out of the process of non-compliance with the regulations when the procurement is actually done. The GPSA, where we will then send the disciplinary referrals to, which will is responsible for the disciplinary being of what emanates from the investigations of SIU. And then the tribunal slash the state attorney that refers to the civil referrals of matters that emanate from the investigation, when we now, due to the also the amendments to the SIU Act, that we mentioned earlier that we are capacitating the civil litigation department so that we can do civil recoveries. The state attorney will also play a very big role there because we'll still be referring some of the matters to the state attorney for assistance. The ACGT, where most of the time there will then be criminal referrals, we play a role there as a partner in the ACGT space. Case in point, we have now the Section 100 intervention where all the parties are playing a role. So most of the cases, they would then go to the DPCI, which then will go to the NPA, SECU, the AFP will play a role there. We'll then now move to the business operations, which is the Chapter 7 slide that I said.
Thank you, Chair and our members. As indicated, the SIU is part of the Product Governance Initiative, which is the anti-corruption tactic, the multi-agency working group initiated by National Treasury to work at the system control of the supply chain management, the DPSA initiative, where we are assisting the DPSA and the Public Service Commission. We have had a significant increase on impact, workload and funding, and our focus now is shifting from the process investigation, that is the DST grant investigation, the Department of Transport and the Housing Subsidy. The shift is towards irregularities in the procurement, and we are receiving a lot of proclamation regarding that. Besides from the SIU contributing to the government initiatives, we also contribute to international efforts against corruption, and we were invited in the anti-corruption summit in Kenya, which was subsequently held also in Zambia this year in May, and then we also received a request to assist Swaziland with the formation and strengthening of their anti-corruption commission. We are building internal capacity to deal with complex investigation in the form of internal training. And the head of the business board will talk about those initiatives. on the operational needs. We regard the SIU as offering a service that is different from other institutions. As you have heard from Advocate Mokata that we are strengthening to litigate our civil cases in the special tribunal, and there's a metering ship going on where we have identified 14 admitted advocates and attorneys internally to strengthen that litigation unit. Obviously for a number of years we have been affected by this adverse judgment, but through the amendment of our act we will be able to use the space of a special tribunal, and we have commissioned a legal review which we have got a report on how to move forward. On the new proclamations, under the financial year 2011-2012, those are the proclamations that we have received and that we have reported on in the annual report, except the Limpopo provincial intervention, the section 100, which we received in March this year. And then for this financial year 2012-2013, those are the new proclamation and extension that we have received, the Guardian Fund, which will investigate maladministration at Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, the CEDA, and the Department of Water Affairs. We have also received a proclamation on the land restitution. Analysis of our performance. Like I have mentioned, there's a focus on shifting from the process investigation, which was mostly statistically driven, whereby we have databases, linked databases of social development. And we are moving toward more complex procurement investigation. If you might call it this financial investigation, where you need a lot of forensic accountant and other center of expertise to be able to give support to the investigation. So the investigation takes longer, but the impact and the relevance that is being seen as compared to your process investigation, whereby you sign an AOD with a beneficiary who received the grants, not entitled to taking the process to court and disciplinary. If the procurement investigation is intensive, massive analysis of documentation, legislative framework, massive financial records from banks, and profiling of people who are involved. So, Mr. Chair, if you see our graph of performance, you see there are decreasing numbers in terms of some of the process investigation driven, like the number of disciplinaries and the number of acknowledgement of that SAR. On the performance information, for the financial year 2011 and 2012, we have seen identified irregularities on procurement investigation to the value of 5 billion rand. Over 5 billion, that is on the performance information is 5.066 billion. Over the past 8 years, 2004-2005 financial year up to 2011-2012, the SIU has saved the government over 1.1 billion, prevented future losses of almost 16.6 billion, recovered over 550 million in cash or assets, prepared evidence for 31,216 disciplinary hearings, prepared evidence for 20,798 criminal cases, prepared evidence for 568,967. This is where you find that we have recommended the cancellation of licenses through the provincial MEC, and also a recommendation to remove all social grants from the social pension system. Now, these numbers are reflected in the performance information that I have been discussing with you. It indicates the target, and it also indicates the actuals. Now, in some cases, Mr. Chair, if you look at the target is based on the data analysis that we received, like from Social Development Department of Transport. Now, in some cases, the actual will be lower than the target, in the sense that when you do a data analysis, you will sort of identify that there are 10,000 or 40,000 irregular grants being issued. But when you start investigating, you might find that some of them, they are actually fraudulent activities. They are just dummy files open where there's no actual beneficiaries who are alive. It's fictitious ideas that have been used, and that is why in some cases our actual non-talk to the target that we have indicated. It might be that we have investigated and we have also found more irregularities. Now, if you look at the performance information on another page, if we can talk to the saving for financial year, those account for 2019-2010, and the prevention of future losses, the cash recoveries, the value of procurement matters where irregularities, that is our new performance indicator, which indicates the 5.6 billion in terms of irregularities found. Now, that is where we have investigated, like in the land reform, we found irregularities in the land being transferred to different types of beneficiaries, and where we have found that in some cases there were no value for money in terms of contracts being awarded. Now, the next item of number of completed investigation contributing to GCPS, that is a target which we are actually running in conjunction with ACTT, whereby we are aiming by 2014 to have prosecuted 100 people who have assets over 5 million and also confiscated their assets. Now, that is it in terms of our performance information. I will hand over to the head of business support material to take us through the business support information. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Paul, and good morning, honorable members. For SIU to deliver on its core mandate, it's depending heavily on a robust support service, and one of them being the human capability and capacity. Just to say the first slide there is to show you how many people we have in SIU. 95 in business support, 50 in business management, 411 in business operations. SIU has actually realized that to be able to deliver on its mandate, it needs to have a strong people-centered approach where people will be able to deliver on their mandate, and where people will feel that we are incapacitated to be able to deliver on their mandate. So we actually move into that direction where we're saying people and our staff, they come first. Just in terms of the skill and the capacity within the unit, you will recall that over the last 2 years, we've been reliant on, or heavy reliance on consultants for skills. Whilst that was happening, in the background, there were other measures that we're putting in place to make sure that over time, we don't have reliance on consultants. And one of them being the recruitment, others being the conversion of temporary staff into contract workers, building our capacity internally for litigating in the Bechar Tribunal. We have a various mentorship programs for cyber forensics, for forensic accountants. We've also had some procurement training internally. The detail of that is in page 7 of the annual report. And we also done the project management training for managers, which we did with the University of Stellenbosch. Alright, and in terms of the, like we've said earlier, a people-centered strategy,
we do recognize that you need a healthy host to be able to deliver. We have embarked on processes to make sure that we settle staff issues. The head of the unit has embarked on roadshows to listen and engage with the staff. She has established the advisory and policy review committee to resolve internal issues, and the relationship with now has actually been strengthened. Just in terms of the appointments at senior level, we've had 15 new appointments over that period. We've had 2 white males, 3 white females. We've had 2 Indian females, 1 colored male, 1 colored female, 5 African males, and 1 African female. Just in terms of the actual composition of the gender, you would see that in 2011, it was only male. But in 2012, you have 6 males and you've got 3 females, and the 3 females are actually in this room at this stage. Also in terms of support to the core mandate is a need to have a robust IT environment. So over the last 2 years, we've embarked in a technology modernization process, building a secure and cost-effective technology foundation. We invested in a modern data center to centrally host all critical systems and data. As one day committee members have time, they can actually visit SIU and we'll see how modernized our IT environment is. Modernized as it might be, we still concerned about the cost, and therefore we did that at a kind of very, not so very expensive cost. The investment has been around 40 million for the past 2 years. We would have loved to do more, but because of cost implications and resources that we don't have, that is how we could go. I send calls here, honorable members, and ask the CFO to take you further from the next slide, financial resources, and I'll take over again.
Good morning, everyone. Just to talk you through a few financial-related slides. I think everybody is well aware, but can I take the opportunity to remind everyone of the cash flow pressures that we've experienced, particularly over the last 6 months. And again, that was started with the issuance of a legal opinion about a year ago, which concluded that the SIU, as a creature of statute, as my legal colleagues would say, was technically not empowered and authorized to charge other state institutions for services rendered. That same process, we started the process to simply have the legislation changed, and as you'll see in a slide or two, those legislative amendments were enacted about a week, maybe just over a week ago on the 2nd of October, and we are now back in a position where we can invoice other state institutions. Again, my learned legal colleague can bear me out. The basis of that invoicing is a bit different and hopefully improved at present. We are able to invoice and charge and recover, and there's no need going forward for us to enter into and negotiate into service level agreements with the state institution. Of course, willingness to pay once that invoice is issued continues to be relevant. And perhaps continue, at least from the finance back office, to be affected, to be concerned about. If we could move on to the next slide. Right, I think we've covered that. Just 2 points to thank the support that we've seen from the Department of Justice, from this committee, and National Treasury. Between National Treasury and the Department of Justice, they did make $3 million available to us late in the last financial year, i.e. March 2012. Thank you. So again, I think we've covered the ground before. With the delay in the timeline around the legislative amendments, we experienced reduced income, reduced cash flow, and we responded by reducing expenditure, discretionary expenditure. Most of that reduced expenditure was on the line item called Invoice Forensic Consultants.
and we also reduce other discretionary expenditure like training, strategy sessions were postponed, and really it was simply a case of reducing our expenditure to a level which was covered and could be covered by our quarterly grant funding allocation. I said already that we are now back in a position where we can invoice. Invoices are going out as we speak, and we are hoping to collect cash which will allow us to set up and put into motion those discretionary expenditure items in the short term. Just to state, if not highlight, that our debtors book at the end of September 2012 was standing at $33 million, and we have engaged with National Treasury for the second time this calendar year with a view to enlisting their assistance to help us to collect those amounts owing. Thank you. All right, on this slide we have a lot of numbers. It's really a summary of the last 3 years of historical results from a financial performance or income statement point of view. We then have our best estimate in the middle column over there of what the numbers are going to be for this financial year. You will see revenue down on last year, although we are still optimistically expecting between now and March next year to invoice out around $100 million for services rendered. Our grant funding for this year is $307 million, the line just above the total revenue line there called transfers received. I would like the committee, or to point out to the committee, that our grant funding allocation effectively declines over the next 2 years. It picks up a little bit in 2015-16 up to $290 million. But if we cast our eyes further down to the expense section, what is again somewhat sobering for us is that compensation of employees is quite soon in the future going to exceed the amount of grant funding that we receive. So what that means, quite simply, is that we would rely then on the receipt, on the payment of invoices from other state institutions to effectively pay our salaries, not to mention rent, telephone, training, strategy conferences and all such good things. Goods and services, included in goods and services is the expenditure on forensic consultants. That is the main reason for the drop in 2012-13. You can see it goes from $272 million in 2011-12 to $135 million in 2012-13. Those are the expenditure cuts I've just been talking about. And then picks up again next year, obviously off the back of our affordability to charge and recover. And then lastly, for what it's worth, we have the bottom line. We, as a Schedule 3A entity, have to budget for a zero surplus or deficit, which, if I may point out, or in comparison to the Auditor General, the Auditor General is under no such constraint. In fact, they do budget for a surplus, they do make a surplus, and everyone may be aware of recent press articles which highlighted that the Auditor General as an entity is owed some 500 million rand by its audit lines. One may ask the question, well, financially speaking, how does the Auditor General manage to fund such a large working capital investment? And if I may offer two short answers from a distance, it's simply the holding of significant cash balances, 352 million, as at March 2011, the annual report was knocked out a couple of weeks ago, and then, as I've just alluded to, by invoicing, or rather budgeting in such a way that they make a surplus to compensate for the delayed payment. Thank you. I'm not going to spend too much time, in fact I'm not going to spend any time on this slide. This is really a breakdown of our expense budget across our three main internal operating divisions, business support, business management, and business operations. If we can move on to the next slide. We just summarise, I think, what we see, the key aspects of our audit opinion, which is obviously part of the annual report. We'd like to highlight firstly that the overall opinion in 2011 and 12 was unqualified, as it was over the last 2 years, and in fact for a number of years prior to that. This year we did receive, as graciously as we could, two emphasis of matter items. The first matter was, in essence, the concern that the Auditor General raised about our funding position, which we've just discussed, and I won't go into any further detail on. The second emphasis matter rather embarrassingly related to a spreadsheeting error on the calculation of the lease smoothing provision. I can go into more detail, but I won't unless there's a need to. Effectively, there's a spreadsheet which is a number of years old. It has been audited for a number of years, and management, when preparing this year's financial statements, picked up an error in that spreadsheet, which was corrected and which is fully disclosed in the notes to the annual financial statements. Thank you. The notes to the annual financial statements also set out four items of irregular expenditure, and because of the profile of that type of expenditure and our position as, I like to say, champions of good public sector corporate governance, we thought it appropriate to make some comments around those items of irregular expenditure. The first one to sum up was expenditure which technically the Auditor General viewed, and I emphasize the Auditor General viewed, as ultra vires. We provided training services to GEMS, and the Auditor General technically, correctly, viewed that as outside of our legislative powers. The second item was an item which was reflected in prior year financial statements. It related to expenditure on forensic consultants which was incurred post the expiry date of a deviation certificate. Now, very briefly, that deviation certificate expired January 2011 and was, in fact, it was last year. So what happened in last year's audit, when the Auditor General raised the matter, is, you know, a certain amount of time had expired, and we could only correct the situation in such a way that left us in a position where for this financial year, March 2011-12, for the period April to August 2011, we actually continued to incur that, that technical regular expenditure. The third item was expenditure on temp employees, I guess conventionally known as temp workers. The situation there is we had gone and employed temp through temp agencies through what I call the natural recruitment process. So agencies were contacted, CVs were asked for, CVs were reviewed, interviews were held, and appointments were made. The AG's views was that this was not a procurement of human resources. It wasn't an employment procurement per se, but it was procurement of human resources through organizations called temp agencies. So they viewed procurement in aggregate. We had viewed the procurement as individualistic of the individual temp workers, and in aggregate, due to the size, the Auditor General viewed it as irregular because we had not embarked on a formal tender process for that. The fourth item relates to the acquisition of certain data analysis, forensic data analysis software that has the name MEMEX. That was procured through a certificate. The certificate was signed off in the second quarter of the 2012 financial year. An order was issued and work began on configuring and customizing that software for use in the SIU. At the date of the audit, June-July 2012, the software had not yet been operationalized, and the Auditor General took us to task because the main reason given in the deviation certificate was that the procurement processes, the normal procurement processes, were to be deviated from because the software was required very urgently. And their point was, we are now some 6 or 9 months down the line, you have operationalized the software, and your argument with the benefit of hindsight is not valid. Thank you. All right, at this point, I will hand back to the Head of Business Support. Thank you.
Chairperson, honorable members, my turn. Just a brief slide on the issue of the governance structures. Not sure whether this noise is bothering you or would like me to move somewhere else. Is it all right? You will see on this slide that we deal with the audit and committee and the risk committee. This is in compliance with the requirements of the PSMA, and also we've looked at T3, For this particular reason, we have this renewed focus on the ICT governance matters that King III has highlighted. We've increased our audit committee by adding three new members, and we now have five external members on our audit committee with a skill base that stretch across audit, internal audit, and ICT. We have also now, in line with the recommendations of King III, established an HR Remuneration and Transformation Committee that consists entirely of external members. At an internal level, our highest decision-making entity in our organization is our Executive Committee, or EXCO, and this focuses primarily on mandate, strategy, and budget. We have also now rekindled a bigger role for our Management Committee, or as better known as MANCO, also consisting, of course, of internal members. And this looks at SAU-wide definition and measurement of performance against strategy, business plans, budget resources, and asset management, and also specifically overseas issues of and risk management within the organization. So I'm asked by our head to continue with the conclusion, which is up there for you to see. We make a few concluding remarks. That the SIU has made considerable strides in dealing with corruption, and he is looking at being able to see some of the matters through independently with the use of its full powers. This is something that we strive for a long time. Adverse judgments by the High Court and Special Tribunal forced us to rely on the aid and cooperation of state institutions to enforce our findings. The recent amendments of our Act now revived our litigating powers, and this would allow us to take the process from initiation right through to final court judgment. The SIU will continue to contribute significantly in all the other efforts against corruption that we dealt with before the Act and the Morgs and the DPSA initiatives, amongst those. And we are committed to building capacity from within and enabling our own employees to perform at their peak and to make the SIU more efficient and effective. Thank you.
That concludes our report, and I just want to also clarify that the annual report that you have in your hand, you know, the new perhaps it's the color changed because of the light, maybe? That's the power protector, that's right. Thank you. Okay, yes.
No, it was this next slide was questions and answers. They seem to have some other things they want to tell us about later, but the next slide is questions and answers. But just thanks for the presentation. Just a range of questions. I'm going to sort of put them all out. I don't know why we haven't raised this before, but your manner of reporting in your annual report is not that helpful. In that it's basically your financial details, well, sorry, it could be more helpful. There's nothing wrong with it, but there could be more information. It's your financial details, and then it's some kind of reports on proclamations. What is missing is issues relating to staff. And it would be useful in future to get that information. So for example, your staff component is only ever presented, it's the same last year, so it's not a change that you've done this year. Your staff component is only something you do in the actual presentation. And there are obviously questions with that. You say you've got a staff component, staff complement of 521. Last year the report was 600. And you envisaged it growing to 706 in the next 3 years. The issue was last year you told us the establishment of 668 funded posts, expected to grow to 706 in the next 3 years. It's gone down then to 521. Can you just give us an explanation around that? But then in future, can you give us details on the staff relating to the number of posts, the number of vacancies,
those kinds of questions. So that's the one. The other then is regarding the proclamations. It's the slide relating to your new proclamations. You've got rural development and land affairs there. It's slide. The slide doesn't seem to be numbered, but anyway, it's the new proclamation. Okay, you've got it there. Now with pivoted departments of public works, you talk about an extension. Got rural development and land reform as a new proclamation. Is this a new proclamation because you were dealing with matters relating to rural development and land reform before? So what is this new one about? And the report from rural development on page 12 of your annual report, it's not particularly it's very similar to what you gave us last year, not in your annual report, but on the slide. And there is a court case pending. I don't know if there's any progress on that court case. But things like the SIU engaged the partners on possible disciplinary action against 8 officials identified in the investigation. I mean, what we want to see as Parliament is disciplinary matters dealt with speedily. So what is the progress on that? And then just still on that slide, the Guardian Fund. You did say it was KZN and Gauteng. We will have the Master's Office coming before us next week. It will be useful to get more information on that in preparation for that. Obviously, we are not doing your investigation. We don't want to prejudice it, but it would just be useful to get a sense of what it is when they come. Then just on financial reports. Now, I'm not an accountant, and I do find that you really have to decode the what the Auditor General is saying, and you've given some of the detail on that. But he did also, or the Auditor General did also raise a number of other issues that the Acting CFO hasn't responded to. Which is things like bank reconciliations not performed on a weekly basis, 100% of the major variances were not explained in the annual performance report, that's number 15, number 16, treasury regulation not being met. Those seem to not be matters relating to what you spoke about, and 17 as well. So just if we can get an explanation there. And then lastly, your financial Auditor General problems started last year, where you got for the first time the Auditor General complaining and saying, it was far fewer issues, but saying management did not have adequate controls, or the accounting authority did not exercise oversight responsibility regarding performance reporting, compliance with laws and regulations and related internal controls. And management did not have adequate controls to ensure that the entity reported on all strategic objectives with regard to performance information. Management did not review and monitor compliance with laws and regulations. So those were the complaints from last year, from the 2011 rather, not this year. Yet, you've now got an acting CFO. Your CFO, I think, left last year, I'm not exactly sure when. But when they left, they got a red flag bonus of 90,000 rand. Now, I understand that is your best possible bonus. How could that happen when they hadn't performed adequately? Because to my mind, saying the accounting authority is not exercise oversight responsibilities regarding performance reporting, compliance with laws and regulations and related internal controls is not good as a layperson. So how could they then get a red flag bonus? Chair, thank you.
So there's rather a lot there, and I want not to add similarly a lot of questions. Acting Head, you've given us reports on your external strategic goal, but there's not much here. as our researchers have pointed out, on the internally focused strategic goals, including the desire to develop an effective, accountable and engaging leadership. Now, may I say that when the FIU used to appear before us under Mr. Hoffman's leadership, it was an entity, I'm being very frank, brimming with confidence, clearly very efficient, and I'm getting a very different impression now. And I want to ask you questions about internal matters which may be contributing to the dispiritedness that I feel around me. A small matter to begin with. How frequently are there executive meetings? We understand, and much of my information comes from my colleague Ms. Schaefer, who can't be here. We understand that the executive used to meet weekly under Mr. Hoffman, but it now very seldom meets. We'll ask McCarthy, please address us on that. Resignations, as I understand it, you have had resignations from the following people at least: Warwick Mayer, head of forensic data; Marika Muller, who we used to see here regularly; company secretary and acting head of communications. I believe one of the reasons she resigned is that she could not reconcile herself with what she was being required to say to the media. Peter Bishop, acting projects director, who was overseeing the core business, and that is the forensic investigation. Project research analyst Karam Singh, who was responsible for initiating and developing new business. Roxanne Ferreira, who had been acting head of internal integrity unit. And Clint Ullerman, another senior project manager. That is a long list of people, and the acting head of the FIU would perhaps like to remark on that. Now the matter of disciplinaries. One of your external tasks is to advise other entities on disciplinaries, but one would like to know what is going on with disciplinary internally at the FIU. Is it the case? The disciplinary proceedings were stopped against the Western Cape head, Mr. Lisa, 10 disciplinary inquiries, of which I understand that he had in fact pleaded guilty to some. Will you comment on that? But now the main issue before us is the case of Ms. Mazira Nyati, and she's of course with us, but it is the acting head of the FIU that I request to answer. Advocate Mukwakla has furnished us with a response for the brief that she gave to the Auditor General on the matter of the reinstatement of Ms. Nyati. I want to ask the following question. Advocate Mukwakla claims that she reinstated Ms. Nyati because she is convinced that the reasons why Ms. Nyati was required to do a polygraph test were inadequate and unsatisfactory. She therefore rejects the simple fact that it was material breach of contract for Ms. Nyati to refuse to undergo the polygraph test, which I find very difficult to understand. Chairman, the issue was the following. The issue is that Mrs. Nyati was alleged to have authored a letter calling for Willie Hoffmeyer to resign as the head of the SIU. That is what triggered the suspension. That is what triggered the requirement that she should do a polygraph test, and indeed her contract and presumably contracts of everybody else require. However, now Advocate Mukwakla decided, according to her brief to the Auditor General, because she disagrees with the reasons why the polygraph was asked, she rejects the entire suspension and dismissal on the basis of refusal to do the polygraph, which is a material breach of contract. Now, she says in her brief to the Auditor General that other people, other staff members, have in the interim
taken responsibility for the letter in question, being the letter calling for the resignation of Willy Hofmeyr. If that is the case, why have you not acted against those persons, ma'am? And is it the case, Advocate McCosler, that in fact the letter calling for Mr. Hofmeyr's resignation was produced on your daughter's computer, whom I believe is called Cora, from an address which is something along the lines of Miseria at Vodamail. If other members wrote such a letter and that has been proven, why have you not acted against them? Did a letter calling for Willy Hofmeyr's resignation emanate from your daughter's computer? That's one set of questions. Now, on the matter of the polygraph, there is a decision of the Labour Court which found that the SIU had lawful reason to terminate Ms. Miseria Nyati's employment for refusing to undergo the polygraph test because it was a material breach of your contract of employment. That decision by the Labour Court should have bound the CCMA, which nevertheless sat on your reinstatement. The settlement achieved at the CCMA was also in breach of your own contract of employment because you repudiated your contract of employment when you refused to undergo a polygraph test. The settlement reached at the CCMA is in breach of the PFMA, and all of this is in terms of legal opinion furnished to yourself. It's in breach of the PFMA because it constitutes irregular, fruitless, wasteless expenditure which could have been avoided with reasonable care, i.e. by opposing the application for reinstatement. The settlement was financial misconduct, and it could in fact result in the dismissal of you yourself, Advocate McCosler. And it is argued in the legal opinion that it is also a criminal offence. It is certainly in contravention of the legal advice to the effect that the dismissal was in fact fair. Now, the reinstatement was, I understand, accompanied by very generous bonus payments, and we'd like you to comment on that also, if you would. But we have what seems to us a quite untenable situation, where Ms. Nyati, despite all the factors that I just said are, is reinstated, is in fact not only reimbursed, but handsomely paid for a period of suspension. And that being the background on which I ask you now to comment, it is perhaps little wonder that the SIU is not the entity that it used to be. Clearly, something is very wrong, and we are losing too many good people. And would you like to answer the question?
Just one question that relates to what Honourable Jackson has actually said. When it comes to the positions, you have 5-1 positions, but I just need to know how many are permanent, how many are temporary, how many are 18, how many of those positions are consulting.
Thank you very much. We'll start with the Jeffrey's question.
Thank you. I'll answer questions on the things of operation and the proclamations. On the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, we have structured our investigation to be in the focus area. Currently, we were investigating the land reform program, and that is reported in the annual report. And subsequently, we had a proclamation on the land restitution, which is also linked to this. And we have also applied for a proclamation in the deed although this report to one department and one minister, we felt that it would be prudent and more effective that we have separate proclamation to deal with them more effectively. And that's the reason why we are having that kind of approach. In terms of the disciplinaries that we need to deal with of the officials involved in this, we have made inroads and we have submitted evidence and files to the department, and we'll be tracking that and maybe give the later progress report on the progress made by the department. On the Guardians Fund, the proclamation relates to the irregularities and maladministration in the Gauteng and KZN. Now this is a new proclamation, and we have allocated resources, and then we are in the process of scoping and moving with the proclamation to the effect. And I will provide details to Mr. Jeffrey on the quest in terms of what it entails, what do we intend to do, and what will be the role of the SIU there. I hope from myself, from this Mr. Boshin, answer Mr. Jeffrey's questions on there.
Yeah, I think just no, that's fine. But I think as far as the audience, would probably be just sufficient. I mean, obviously we could access it as well. But you would have it on your file if we can just get a copy of the proclamation. It's more just from a sense of, so we don't need to know what you're doing. We want to just know what you're investigating, so that when they come next week, we've got that information. So if you could supply that, not to me but to I think committee secretary, just a copy of the proclamation, because I imagine that would set out what you meant to investigate.
Honourable members, I will deal with two questions from my space. One being the staff composition, and the other one being around internal controls. The point is taken. And we will make sure that our annual report actually breaks down the number of staff that we've got in terms of race, gender, the level of skills and all of that. That information is there because it's required every year. We have to submit that to the Labor Department. So we do have that. It's just a matter of consolidating it into the annual report. The second one relates to the findings by the AG that for the first time we have we start to have issues like the method of emphasis, the findings, and the bank reconciliation and all of that. We have noted that. I just can give the honourable member the comfort that in terms of the bank reconciliation, we have tried to speak to National Treasury to get an exemption from being exempted to do a bank reconciliation on a weekly basis to a monthly basis, but that was rejected by National Treasury, so we're back to doing the bank reconciliation on a monthly basis. But just generally, all the findings that are in the annual report, we know all of them. In the interest of time, we didn't want to flag a slide where we would say this has been the findings per section, and this has been the repeat findings. So we have our finger on the pulse in terms of all the findings. And the treatment actions as well, we've got all of them. We've got a spreadsheet in terms of what it is that we need to do. Going back to the governance structures that you saw, it is one of the reasons why we're strengthening them, because some of the findings, they come from IT, and we needed to have somebody with an IT background in the audit committee to be able to guide us in terms of some of the findings. So the strengthening of the governance structure also relates to the internal controls that we've realized that we've got a few other things as well. And then there was another question about the finance post. Last year, I think there was a report around 656, and this year we're talking about 521. We're talking 521 warm bodies that we're talking about. But I need to also highlight the fact that SIU is a project-based organization, so it depends on the project. We're flexible. Sometimes we need to have more and sometimes we need to shrink. Thank you.
Just to finalize on the Mr. Jeffrey's questions, yes, it will be more helpful to
to include such information in the report, and we take that point, and we hope in the future that it will be done that way. We spoke about it earlier, that we need to put more narrative which is more readable and easily understandable. On the second question,
question which hasn't been answered, which was the issue of the bonus for the former CFO. The problems with the Auditor General, in fact, started the year before, and it appears as though he got a palpable bonus for that period.
Chairperson, honorary members, just building up to an answer to that question by Honourable Mr. Jeffrey, I will answer one of the previous questions he had asked about the PEAT finding on performance information compared to the previous year. You would see from our earlier presentation that we have changed our strategic objectives. There is now only one strategic objective and seven strategic drivers. The big problem was that we used to have eight strategic objectives that included those drivers, and the Auditor General's finding was that we did not have performance targets for those other seven drivers, which were more internally focused drivers. Now, that finding was made during the audit, the 2010-11 audit. The report came out in the end of August that particular year, by which time it was already too late for us to correct the error in that particular year, because we were already halfway through the new financial year. That is why the same finding appears in two audit reports for two consecutive years. That has been addressed fully. There is a proper policy in place now to deal with performance information, and we believe that problem will go away and will not appear again in next year's report. Just linked to that is also the question Honourable Jeffrey pointed out, some of the findings by the Auditor General relating to non-compliance with Treasury regulations, irregular expenditure findings. Now, our CFO did point out briefly that some of these findings were technical in nature, and I want to illustrate some of those technicalities. For instance, the issue of the training on gyms. We believe we could train them. They approached us. Can you please train our forensic staff in forensic investigations? We will pay you for that. We agreed to that because our Empowering Act makes us a juristic person. We thought we'd be entitled to enter into contracts with other people. And in fact, we did so. And we did so for a significant period. In previous years, these facts were placed before the Auditor General. They audited it. They were happy on the strength of their approval. We renewed this contract. In the last year, they changed their mind and said, you know, strictly speaking, this is after we raised your act, and therefore it is unlawful, and we will not, this is irregular expenditure. We would not have done that if we didn't have, let's say, the stamp of approval in previous years. The same thing happened with the temps, the temporary workers. Yes, yes, indeed so. Indeed so. In fact, Chairperson, it's a strange phenomenon. It's not really irregular expenditure, it's irregular income, because we didn't pay for it, we received money for that. Similarly, with the temp workers, for years we embarked on the same process. We regarded each individual temporary worker as a separate contract that did not require a tender. And then it was audited year after year by the AGSA, and they had no problem with the system we employed. This year they changed their mind and they said, no, this is irregular. And then we got, on the strength of previous stamps of approval, we continued. The same, the issue of the consultants, as the CFO pointed out, there was a window between two deviation certificates that was not covered by the first one, where we slipped up. So, but there was value for money in each instance with the tents and also with those workers. Unfortunately, I think the committee is aware that the HESA does have certain fixed language that they use when they make their comments. It's a cut and paste job from prescribed comments. They always read a lot worse than what they what they really are. Even if you have one instance of irregular expenditure of 5,000 rand, they will say in the report, the leadership did not exercise proper control to prevent irregular expenditure. We have those limited instances of irregular expenditure, and as I say, most of them are of very technical nature. But to return to the question at hand, the bonus to the CFO, the main issue of performance information is not under the control of the CFO at all. It is regulated from within the operational space. So we have a section within operations that keep record of performance information, and the finance office is not involved in maintaining that information and reporting on it at all. So that shortcoming could not be attributed to the CFO space whatsoever. As far as the issues of non-compliance is concerned, I hope my earlier explanation of the technical nature thereof would point out that it's not something that we could say that the CFO caused the organization any loss and that failed in her duties in doing so. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I am now going to come to the second set of questions. I am going to start with the first one, that FIU was dealing with confidence and now a different picture is seen. I must say that perceptions are very subjective. It depends on the eyes of the beholder. You hear me quiet, you say I'm not confident, but hear me speak, you will hear that I'm confident. Right? That's a metaphor, the person who is perceiving that. I would say that the SIU is not in any way in a state of being dispirited or despondent or anything. And in fact, it does exude that confidence that I don't know why it's not seen. As to the frequency of how meetings of EXCO are held, I would start by saying that the effectiveness of an organization of leadership does not necessarily depend on how many meetings you hold. You can hold 20 meetings in a week, but not be effective. It depends on the impact of what you're talking about and what decisions come out of that. And I would say that, you know, there have been times where we have held more than two meetings in a week, depending on the urgency of meeting with EXCO members. We have been in a different situation. It was not business as usual. It has been business unusual ever since I started at SIU, dealing with people's issues and all of that. The report speaks for itself that we even embarked on roadshows to go around and engage in the people. So as you are aware, you will not be sitting with EXCO in a meeting, but we have been engaging. Insofar as resignations are concerned, yes, we acknowledge that the people who have left had the skills to do the work, to be a witness, as I and if I use an employer of choice, it makes sure that the people are capacitated and are very efficient and qualified to do the job that they do. So it is not a happy time when people leave, when it was a nice, big, happy family. Names were mentioned, but further than that, it's now mentioned that one of the employees who left because she was very required to say something to the media, that the news to us has come as a surprising fact. It's not even expected, it's kind of a surprising allegation. But the long and short is to say that the people we had left, we have spoken to them, and it was a nice parting. They were going for greener pastures. You can't stop the person from growing in terms of their career and all of that. Another name was mentioned. It comes as a surprise today that the person has left. I'm not aware of any resignation letter from Ms. Roxanne Ferrer. And I must say that farewell parties were held for almost all the people here. Warwick had a farewell workshop with the party for him. Marga, she defined that. Project director, we had a nice parting breakfast. And Karam, we had a very long conversation and we've gone for new pastures. So thank you very much for that she has resigned. She has not resigned. She died Chief Alderman, she worked up to the last day we were holding a such session, and you know, it was commendable of him to attend to a very, very last minute. Other people would not have, because that was the last day on which he was to be with us. We also had a very nice parting session for him. And so far as the disciplinary matters, it is asked what is happening at SIU. Are proceedings now being stopped? What is the position? The disciplinary proceedings against Mike Lisa, who is in the Western Cape, were not stopped. As you say, he had pleaded guilty to some of the offences, but they were not dismissible offences, and this was discussed with all relevant parties' consent, and he received his sanctions on that, and he returned on those bases. Insofar as the reinstatement now of Iseria Nyathi, I must say that the brief to the Auditor General was only sent to the Auditor General and not to anyone else, and it came as a surprise that it is now in hands of third parties. But nevertheless, the brief that was written by SIU is now being read piecemeal to portray a picture of, how can I put it, it's not portraying the right picture. Certain aspects are not read in context, and as a result, it comes out bad. Yes, indeed, the issue was the originated from a letter which it was alleged was drafted by Mrs. Nyathi, calling for the resignation of Mr. Willy Hofmeyr. And that was indeed what triggered the suspension. Now, in a matter which has been reviewed, the aggrieved person will write representations to you and say, I have been wrongfully charged, here are the reasons. And once you receive that, you also embark on your own investigation and you consult the relevant parties, you consult all that were involved in the matter, having looked at the representations of the aggrieved person. You consult with EXCO, you consult with lawyers to get opinions. Now, having done that exercise, I found that in the first instance, there were indicators that were pointing to a particular direction, and those were not taken up at that time. It is not true to be saying that there are people who subsequently owned up to the letter. The people owned up to the letter, that they authored the letter at that time, before the Labour Court proceeded. The Labour Court did not say that SIU must dismiss Ms. Nyathi. The Labour Court announced that if there is a breach of a material term in a contract, you can dismiss on those bases. It was still up to SIU to dismiss or not to dismiss. I am reading through all this because it involves a whole lot of things. You will be able to decipher and understand if you were to go through the court papers that were filed, the affidavits that were filed, the relief that was sought, and the judgment, having looked at it, and what is it that the judgment was addressing, was it addressing the issue, was going beyond the issue, and so forth. Insofar as the maybe before I go to the legal opinion, there were also allegations that there was fraud committed by Mrs. Nyathi. But when you look at the papers, as I said, to the papers of the Labour Court, the papers of the disciplinary, the suspension letter, what was included in the suspension letter, you will see that at the end of it all, when you consult with the parties, and the parties are telling you that we were never asked to do an investigation on fraud on Mrs. Nyati. And that is the integrity unit of FIU, which says we were never asked to do that and there were no charges of fraud leveled against Mrs. Nyati. Now when it comes to the opinion that is now talked about, which was not an opinion, it's that Mrs. Nyati has been found guilty of fraud. You will be committing financial misconduct if you do the investigation. Now, having said that there was no investigation of fraud on Mrs. Nyati, then it goes without saying that the opinion, or which I don't term an opinion, was not proper in the circumstances, because it was talking about facts that I must say in terms of the issue at hand regarding SIU as well as Mrs. Nyati. I'm not saying it wasn't an opinion. An opinion is something that a party will ask from you, would you please give me an opinion, and you get a brief as to what is it you need to address in your opinion. And I do not know also as to how it was a memorandum, as to how the memorandum then was leaked out, which was a private arrangement between SIU and its lawyers. However, be that as it may, it has leaked out. It was a memorandum which came together with the settlement agreement, which then informed me that you are committing financial misconduct if you reinstate a person who has been found guilty of fraud. And I checked the criminal record. I did not find any record which relates to Mrs. Nyati having been convicted of fraud in any forum. I've checked the SAP 9s, I did not find anything. I have checked the records of SIU and I did not find anywhere where Mrs. Nyati was said to have been found guilty of fraud. In a legal space, you will find that people may come with different opinions using the same set of facts. You look at the law, you look at the case law, you look at how scholars or other legal people have come to deal with same issues as to how then they assess the situation. I did that exercise. I consulted with EXCO. I also consulted with the head of legal at SIU. It was discussed at EXCO level and we went through everything and we came to a point where we were saying this is the right course to take. The type of computer that you are mentioning, there has not been any finding that there is a letter that comes from a computer of a daughter or anything of the sort. This information, I don't know how it came to be talked about. There isn't anything like that. There was, however, an exercise that was done to go through the emails of Mrs. Nyati, and this letter was not found. There was an opinion that came from a cyber specialist, and the cyber specialist did not come with a conclusion that this letter was authored by Mrs. Nyati. To say that the settlement in the CCMA was in breach of the CCMA, I would dispute that for the same reasons that I have highlighted earlier on, that the exercise that was not done lightly. I looked at all the relevant factors that needed to be taken into account. We wonder why SIU is not what it used to be. We have just come out of a start plan session where we were talking about the change of culture and transformation in the SIU, where people were feeling despondent, feeling that if they have to say they are sick, they will be victimized. We are saying we want to have a culture of transparency, of accountability, and a culture of visibility, visible and servant leadership. So I do not understand what is this supposed to mean, or is it echoing my sentiment that yes, it's not what it used to be, it is better than it was. In terms of the spirit of the people, it was said earlier on in our report that we have now strengthened relationships between all the stakeholders, especially the relationship between the SIU as well as now, because most of the issues were then coming out of the miscommunication and the misunderstanding between the SIU and the Nahau members, which are making the bulk of making up the bulk of the members at SIU. Going back to the real crux of the matter as to why the reinstatement, when you look at a case, whether you need to fight it, you need to settle it, you need to negotiate around the process of going through with the case. You look at how much money you're going to be spending if you proceed with the matter. How much have you already spent in the matter? Was it a justifiable amount in the first place? And all that is happening, with all the information that comes at hand as to how you could best handle it, or could have handled the matter if now you get into a matter midway. I looked at the expenses that had already been incurred up to the time where the CCMA had to sit. We were already spending at about 750,000 just on the case of missing action. And looking at what the issues are, why are you refusing to submit a polygraph test? In the AG's report, it is very comprehensive there as to why it was a refusal. Firstly, the conduct of the employer was unbecoming. It is embarrassing to admit that sitting here as the acting head of SIU. Because several methods were used, and that was admitted, that a person is called under false pretenses to a particular venue for a particular purpose. When you get there, you find it's a different purpose altogether. And at the same time, you are asked to do things, and later on, you receive telephone call to apologize that, sorry, we called you on a false pretense. And now, you wonder if you say, submit to a polygraph test as to what the outcome of the test is going to be. So it worried me, and it placed a deeper concern on me, because the first question would be, how did you approach this matter? The second one is, in course of investigation, you are SIU, you are a forensic investigation unit. You know that you get a red flag, you have to still dig further and see to it that yes, the red flag that you are picking up talks to the end result. You take a particular direction and you omit to look at other areas. There are other indicators that indicate that you should go to the left, but you still proceed and go to the right because you want to go to the right. It pains me to be saying this right now, because it looks like I am putting the blame on certain individuals, but it has to be said because it is not going to stop. There have been a lot of media queries around this, and I am hoping that today will put a stop to that. I do acknowledge that people have different approaches in approaching certain issues in their spaces. But my worry is that once the conduct is questionable, once there is something that points to a particular motive then you will have a hard time pushing that story forward in another forum. But a story has to answer about 6 questions. You fail to answer at least 2 of those questions, you are doomed. So the crucial question that needed to be answered in the story of Lizzie Anyadi is to why was she required to submit to a polygraph test in the face of lack of evidence, in the face of the manner in which this was investigated. In my exercise of consulting with the relevant people, complainant, the employer, employer's representative, and so forth, it did come out that there were elements of factors that were bordering on the lines of criminality, where then people were asked to do certain things. Some of them did this, some of them refused. Now, in a forum like the CCMA, where you are talking about the unfairness of a decision of an employer, all goes into the pot. Unless you try and crystallize the issues in a pre-trial conference or in a pre-up meeting. And in the case of Mrs. Mizeri Anyadi, the issues were not crystallized. So everything was going to go into the pot, and it was going to be a really embarrassing situation for SIU. And perhaps the country at large. The
Virginia, are you saying settlement was concluded in order to avoid a ventilation of issues that would have been embarrassing?
I'm not saying it was halfway, but that was an inevitable situation that was going to happen. It's one of the factors, but it was not the catching factor. The catching factor was that there was no evidence pointing to anything against Mrs. Mizeri Anyadi that she has been either found guilty of fraud or has authored a letter or had played a part in authoring a letter that calls for the resignation of the head of the unit. You also asked about the performance appraisal that was paid. Now, this is a reinstatement. And if it is a reinstatement to a retrospective effect, a person must be put in a position in which the person was before the happening of the event. The status ante is restored. Now, it was impossible to restore the status ante because it would have been when you have to appoint a person, he has to be on the job, she has to be on the job, yes. But if you look at the past performances of Mrs. Mizeri Anyadi and the marks that she has got, it was nothing below 80. Now the performance appraisal that she then got as per the advice of the HR, the head of HR, is that you give the national average, which was at 76.4 or 4.5 or 6. I'm not sure of what the number was after the point. The records show that she was a high performer. An exco can bear with me on this one. They have said this in an exco meeting that she is a very hard worker and they all wanted her to succeed. That is what I got from them, and this is what has resulted in the performance appraisal being set at 76.4. It would have been higher. So the state of ante was not restored as it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be at a higher level, but we were not in a position to put it at the 80, 85, 86 that she was. I'm just checking if I'm not missing out anything. Insofar as effective and accountable leadership, I would say the facts speak for themselves. We don't need to be blowing our horn in this regard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, I mean, thanks for the explanation. Just to say that I'm not sure where it came from, but I mean, we all have the brief to the Auditor General, and I must say I think it's been useful. So I don't know if it was formally submitted or whether it came from the Smuts but I mean, but anyway, we've all got it, and I think it was useful. So I don't share the same view. Maybe just to say that definitely corrupt officials have no place in the public service, definitely not an institution investigating fraud and crimes. And similarly, non-performing officials don't have a place either. But having heard the interaction, both Ms. Mutz's questions and the response, I mean, really, it seems to be a storm in a teacup. I had read about the matter in the media. I was surprised, and it seems to be common cause, to learn that the matter for the polygraph test was not relating to allegations of having committed a crime, but the author or involvement with a letter. Now, I think it's generally known that polygraph tests are not accepted as evidence in criminal cases where the burden of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. They are accepted in civil matters or labor disputes, labor matters where it's a lesser burden. But the reason they're not accepted in criminal matters is that they're not liable. That you can, I understand they relate to how your body reacts and your blood pressure and things like that. So you can train yourself to stay calm when you're in fact lying. And if you're a particularly excitable person, you can be accused of lying when you in fact are not. I can understand the necessity for a polygraph test for serious complaint of like fraud, corruption, stealing dockets, accepting money. But really, I just think this is a non-issue. I think the position that Ms. Mukate found herself in was that she could dismiss, but it's a question of should she dismiss? Was it fair? And I can understand, I'm obviously was not in her position, but I can understand why she would come to that position. I mean, obviously anonymous letters are annoying and troublesome, and because the person is not confronting you, but Chair, as you know, this committee has an anonymous letter complaining about matters in the Public Protector's Office, which has been referred, which the Public Protector referred to the Speaker to deal with, who then referred it to us. Now, I'm not aware of the Public Protector wanting staff members to take polygraph tests to establish the report of the letter. Public Protector's response is, okay, somebody must investigate. There were concerns raised in this letter. Somebody must investigate. Let Parliament do it. So, Chair, I just don't... I think it hasn't been particularly well put out in the media. I think, contrary to what Advocate Mukate says, that the brief to the Auditor General is useful, the explanation to the Auditor General is useful. I think it would be useful if there could be a good press statement issued. It's not necessarily saying there wasn't one, I don't know, but it hasn't been coming out. Right? The impression was that the matter related to a lot more than who authored a letter. But even on Ms. Smutter's version, from what she was putting, it seems it common cause that it was later. But then having said that, I mean, I think obviously both in the past and currently with the information being supplied to Ms. Smuts or to Ms. Schaefer, that it's an indication of problems. The anonymous letters in the past were an indication of problems. The one concern, Advocate Mukati, seems to be that you know, the management meetings are not convened regularly. Maybe that is something you should look at, that they are convened more often so people have got time. Well, not more often, but they are convened regularly so people have the chance to, an avenue to ventilate, because leakages seem to take place when people are unhappy and they don't feel empowered. So maybe that's something that you could look at, even though you say that the meeting takes place often, but if it's not a set meeting date time, it maybe becomes more difficult if the meetings are just called on particular issues. So that would be a suggestion for something to look at. But Chair, on the issue of Mr. Zimyati, I really think it's a non-issue.
Could I ask, you may wish to allow us to ask as a committee, but could I ask for a copy of the legal advice from Advocate Brandis? Secondly, is there a second legal opinion, which I believe of my information comes from the Schaefer, but we understand that a second opinion was to exactly the same effect. Would you have objection to furnishing Brandis' opinion to us? Or the legal advice, or the, whatever it was?
On that issue, my worry is that if the issue was around a failure to take polygraph tests for a criminal action, and as far as I understand it, the Labour Court decision is, look, it is breach of contract. Your contract requires you to take a polygraph test. If you don't, you can be dismissed. So she could have been dismissed. The question is, should she have been dismissed? In terms of the facts of this case, the polygraph test was required for a personal issue, effectively. And I'm not sure whether the opinions will help us, because presumably the opinions may say, well, the same thing, you can or you shouldn't, but it seems to be a value judgment around internal matters within the organisation. So,
in terms of the opinion are that the settlement itself was unlawful, therefore in breach of PMSA, and might even amount to criminal offence. Those were the terms of the opinion from Eminence Counsel. It seems to be useful, but the advocate can tell us whether she considers to be whose private and legal advice that is. But I do not even know whether Ms. Schaefer might have a copy of that opinion. I ask now without knowing whether in fact we have one. I myself would like to read that opinion.
My initial sentiment would be no, I wouldn't want to give that, for the simple reason that if you look at the opinion as you're looking at the brief also, that the opinion or the memorandum is talking about a person having been found guilty of fraud. So it won't be helpful to anyone in that regard, because it talks about issues that are not present before me when I was reviewing the decision. So it won't help anybody, so it shouldn't be out there. Now the question will be what was in the brief to counsel, what was said to counsel, and it is going to involve a whole lot of people, if we can just lay the matter to rest, because then that opinion or memorandum will not ask anyone in this regard.
Thanks, Chair. We welcome the briefing from the Auditor General on MSNYC. And I just have the notion that we should welcome the report and work towards really closing the matter. When it comes to my earlier question on number 38, I just want to give an idea as to where we are in terms of consultants. Remember last time when we had a report, we had a lot of consultants. So if you can just give a percentage, then now they've dropped to at least around this percentage, because previously when you reported, you had about 2/3 of employees in consulting. I just want to have an idea of what the situation is all about currently. And then we know it's actually emphasis of matter, no provision for invoices, which is actually something that needs to be taken care of when balance sheet is certainly constructed, whether it's training, whether it's providing services to government departments, you need to ensure that such information is available on the spreadsheet. And another thing that I want to just talk about is compliance with laws in terms of the financial report, which is financial statement from the Auditor General. And it's written here, we know you're aware of this, but we want to actually have it noted during the course of the meeting that you have not been in the position to submit the strategic plan 6 months before the start of the financial year, which is something that needs to be avoided in future. And I've actually begun the calculation. Now it's 6 months before the next financial year. I wonder whether the strategic plan for the next financial year has already been submitted. Is it ready to have implications to the budget? So that needs to actually be taken care of. Also, it indicates that the account authority did not maintain effective, efficient, and transparent systems of internal controls, which is something that needs to be noted and corrected for the future. Financial statements were not prepared in all material respects. It further indicates that the account authority did not take effective steps to prevent irregular expenditure. All of these are concerning, and we're hoping the next audited financial statements will actually find such concerns from the Auditor General. Thank you.
I commend you on the efforts of taking us away from the Nyati matter.
I thought my comments were saying we are fine.
Yes, but some of us need to say a few things as well.
Having listened to all this deliberation, it reminds me of a little Latin, Neminis non curatile, who is so insignificant that we should not spend much time on this matter. We should say this. I take that point, but I think and African Okhate will understand why I'm saying this brief to the Auditor General was extremely helpful. In fact, this brief should have come to the committee alone. It would have assisted us in this, you know, looking at it from a distance. I know that if you know the committee has this concern. Some of them expressed the concern and others could see it by their body language. Clearly, when someone is called for a performance appraisal and then served with a short suspension, that brings all kinds of alarm bells. It's true, and I say this as one who had to undergo polygraph tests in the last 18 years as an Iraq civil committee. Polygraph tests can be manipulated. Mr. Jeffrey has alluded to two examples of how they are. The experts tell me that there are certain drugs. If you take the drug or the one of the test, it doesn't matter what questions are posed to you, it'll be almost like a flatline, like a zombie thing, and that's fine. On the other hand, the person doing the test can also make it. You don't know what's there. You're sitting here, the person is sitting behind you in front of a screen of this monitoring, and they go away, and a week later you're told that they will pass, they will fail. And no one explains to you how they reach that conclusion. Which leads me to my next point. You say that this is a contractual requirement, obligation. I think I have a problem with this. I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. Now, in terms of this particular matter, I can understand why Ms. CRT was saying no by any and put a life in the hands of other people by refusing to undertake the project. If it's contractual, then what do you do? It's a little weird that this is part of yes. I, you know, you may
understand the need for it. I understand the need for it. Doing the work that you're doing. There are people in the SMU, everyone, from such a person, are required to be speaking. And I think that... Well, yes. Sure, but then, you see, I'm called for a performance appraisal. And at this performance, I'm coming there with a particular frame of mind. I'm going to do an appraisal of my performance. Then I receive a letter of suspension. Then, you know, then immediately that creates problems. Well, then the person who served the letter of suspension would need to explain why it was done in that fashion. And I'm sorely tempted to say, let's call that person or persons here so they can explain. In fact. Well, be that as it may.
The common cause is the Labour Court said she could be dismissed.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. And the question for me is, should you be dismissed for refusing to take a polygraph test for something not actually relating to criminal conduct or for simply writing an anonymous letter or checking whether you wrote that letter? That is the question. So I have no doubt she could have been dismissed. It was breach of contract in terms of the Labour Court decision. The question of was that appropriate?
And I think the requirement for polygraph tests is precisely that, is to ensure that the people in the SAE from top to bottom don't engage in criminal activity. Whether this was something that falls within that category, I think so. I guarantee. You know, it's something that needs to apply with certain section. Alright. This wasn't a hearing, but it was important. No, it wasn't. It seemed that way, but it was important for us to understand the facts. I don't claim that it is. Jeffrey is correct. If the media had received the speech to the Auditor General, it might have assisted in that. We've been dealing with this situation. There's all kinds of problems in the SA. I'm not saying that they are, and I'm not saying that they aren't. Let me try and move away from this matter by mischievously dealing with one particular matter, and I'd like your response to it.
Before that, does Ms. Francis point around the irregular expenditure? Presumably the Auditor General will advise us on that.
Yeah. We can ask the Auditor General to...
Well, it will come, it will be something they would look at in the routine course, so it's not something that's just being left.
You say that you now have a nice relationship now, and that's to be welcome. And then, somewhere in your report, you tell us that you're moving away from temporary release, contract markets, because of expertise, you're now deciding to train you. But in the meantime, are you going to the agencies? It's one of the issues that the Auditor General has touched on. The agencies are labor workers. And you know that they how we are opposed to labor workers. This is the mystery point. Crazy. Notwithstanding your excellent relationship with the town, how are you going to give access to that report? The second matter, which is in the same light, is the fact that again you train staff. I don't know how you're going to, if you're able to respond to this. They're going to be headhunted. You correctly pointed out that anyone with SIU is deemed to be an employee, and you're already facing that. It will not be the worse now once you've started training for the experts to do the work that contractors and others do. Those are just a few of my points of issue. You can just continue. Thank you.
Well, yes, it's true that the you know, the case to labor brokers. But if you look at the spend on employees that are coming from labor brokers, the lead is high because of that portion of the commission and so forth. And that it also kills us because then we have to pay this amount and these people are not emanating into our space. So now when you absorb them into our space, we can utilize them and pay a little bit less money. Not that we don't value the work of a person doing their work. Also to normalize our funding model so that we don't come here over and over again, say we approach and dream. We'll shrink and expand, we'll shrink and expand, so that at least there can be consistency in some of the things that you do, that when you talk about employee compensation, you talk about this much for budget purposes and so forth. There is a program that we are embarking on in terms of making sure that we retain the people that we are giving the skills to. We understand that you cannot hold a person to ransom, that you must work for me for 10 years. That will be unconstitutional. And we can't also say there's a restraint of trade. You can't work for, say, National Treasury or work because now, yeah. But there is a system that we are putting in place, especially now for the forensic lawyers that we are training at the moment. But at least give it 3 to 5 years, still working for SIU, and make sure that in that 3 to 5 years, there is an intake, and then you make sure that there is a transfer of skills, and then that the ones that are coming in will be ready to carry on with the work. Those who are tiring or expiring can leave the others to be able to do the work. On the number of staff, the question was not adequately answered. I will leave that to Miseria to talk about the staff, the 521 who are the consultants, and what percentage of the consultants do we have left now. In terms of the 6 month period, I will leave that to Zola in terms of strategy plan. And the other queries that were raised by the Auditor General, I will leave them to Richard Gans. It's not to GV. I don't want to take the punch out of the answer that he's going to give.
Thank you, honourable members. I think the number 521 is all permanent SIU people. There are no consultants in there. The approach that we have taken is that we view them drastically, the consultants, the valuable consultants. Yes, we still have them. We've got about 26 right now consultants, but those are only needed in various specializations. So the approach is we get them to train. Once we are sure that we can run that skill on our own, then we send them out. So that is the approach. But the 521 is solely SIU in training. If I can just add on the question that was asked by a member in terms of losing staff to competition, training them and losing them. One of the things that we remarked on in the past two, three months is that we were doing salary benchmarking with other organizations that are doing special investigation. And then we were not doing in terms of salaries. We looked at the Financial Services Board, the Public Protector, FinStar, and other institutions. It was about 2 or 3 months ago, and Financial Intelligence Center, and our rates are competitive. So we're confident that in training and the risk of losing them is minimal.
In terms of the question asked, we have submitted by the end of August to the minister in line with the guidelines. So we have rectified this information.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just perhaps relating also to an earlier question about the resignations that were mentioned. It is, the question was sort of created the impression that the people leaving is indicative of a certain internal problem or purging or something along those lines. I had a look at the names that were mentioned, and I agree that Ms. Ferreira has not resigned. The senior members mentioned there, in particular, I want to mention Warwick Meyer, Peter Bishop, and Clint Ullman, who are all senior managers and all people that I would regard as personal friends, and therefore I have personal information as to why they left. It's quite obvious why they left. They left for much bigger offers that they got elsewhere. They one left for Sasol, one left for Anglos, and one left for Competition Commission, and they were offered salaries which was significantly higher than what we were paying them, and which we could not meet. We could not make within our structures counter offers which could retain them. Similarly, Karam Singh, that has left for the Human Rights Commission, has not left as a disgruntled member. He has left for better opportunities also in that area. He was not a senior manager. He played an important role in the organization, and he was not a senior manager. Marika Miller, I will hear for the first time the comments that were made earlier, but she also left for a job at SARS, which is also, in my understanding, a more senior position than the one she had at the SRE. So yes, we have a problem retaining our top staff, and it's a bit disturbing if we lose them to other state institutions. And we may want to ask some questions of how we can prevent that sort of a problem. It's very difficult, of course, but we need to look at that. Just on the issue that was raised about some of the comments that the AG makes in its report, I did refer to it earlier that they like to use these cut and paste comments, which are very general. And to use one example, in the report, when they refer to irregular expenditure, they make a statement that item 26 in the report, it says, the accounting authority does not take effective steps to prevent irregular expenditure as required by section, etc. of the PFMA. Now, we disagree with them on this point, and we argue with them in the audit committee on this. They should say, in three or four instances, the SIU leadership failed to do so, amounting to X amount. But the way they put it, it always looks like nothing has been done. And even in the examples that the Honourable Member quoted earlier, when they talk about in all instances, they fail to safeguard in all instances. Now, that could sound as if it was done in no instance, but what they're trying to say is we didn't succeed to prevent this in all instances, one or two maybe might have slipped through. So I think the committee would be well aware of that sort of language that appears in the reports. It doesn't mean that nothing is done at all. It just means that there were an instance or maybe two where they could make a finding, which is actually reflected in a report and which you can evaluate on its own.
I just want to hold the committee to ask if this is not succeed when you discuss management later. Because during that period, actually, maybe I need to explain to them, to have them understand that this is not really going to help them, so that they can actually remove it from the record.
Thank you, Chairperson. We do have that, and we actually have that every year. I'm actually representing management on the audit committee, and with our Chairperson, who is the head of the Chartered Accountant Training Facility at the University of Pretoria, he also takes this up with them, but they just don't do it, because that is what their precepts in their office say that they must do. They stick to that language. It's a template. It's not, they're not allowed to amend it. So we fight with them every year, there is a change.
But a strong recommendation was made that it should be reviewed because it doesn't portray the true picture to the reader.
Speaking about a true picture,
maybe wrong in saying this, but I do say so. Maybe you need to look seriously at the communication strategy. Now, whether I agree with this or not, the picture SIU is portraying now is not a yellow day. The important thing is that there may well be a problem as far as that's concerned. And also, your communications, I think that you have some great communications, you may need to look at that. I'm going to use Christine's document. Christine's a content advisor. And just raise some of the issues that they have raised. Issue is taken with minimal information, which actually you need to just in your annual report. About the organizational structure, what we've done, the units, three divisions, human resource issues, and so on. And you would need to look at that. Very much you can do today. Certainly, this was what we got in the past. And so when we read the annual report now, and we can see the ask. So it would also be useful in your annual report there is more information on collaborative work done by PCTT, NAWG, you pronounce that more, and WASP. Something called scoping. I think I understand what he means. You probably understand it better than I do. But apparently you're conducting the productive risk exercise in contravention of the Act. Amazing, because anything done in contravention of the Act is a serious charge. And so I can't just brush it aside and move on without getting a response from you. So he says, yeah, you do it in order to assess if there's sufficient motivation for a proclamation. But he says this is in contravention of the Act because it provides some, just address that for us, please, so that there needs to be some kind of response. So that it could happen in the future, we'll know that, well, maybe even done. All right.
Thank you, Chair. We have already acknowledged that we will put more beef and more detail into the report so that it is easily understand. Yes, communications, we have put it as our number one risk in our risk register, and we are doing something about it, and I'm sure the results will be comfortably felt by February, not next financial year, but February 2020. Yes, the collaboration with the other agencies, we could see more and around that, perhaps maybe it was in fear that we will be doing the whole in our report, but it was that point we take and we'll put more detail. The capacity with the civil litigation unit, there is a review process that has been embarked on, and it should be finalized by last week. GV, can you elaborate more on the result of the outcome of the legal review? However, we'll still be outsourcing some of the work.
I'm not sure whether I should respond immediately and interrupt my boss. On this point, obviously we have a significant number of lawyers in our organization. We do intend using a mixed model here of dealing with some matters internally, but a significant number of our lawyers have not actually physically litigated in the recent past. And I think it would be unfair in an environment where we need to settle new law on certain issues to throw our teams into matters where the disputes may involve 500 million rand or 800 million rand and matters like that. So we do anticipate that we will in some instances outsource and use outside counsel to lead us in those matters.
Back to me again. On the funding model being compromised because we are unable to invoice, very true, but we are, let's go back to the slide of how we have normal cash flow info. Where is that? After this, I think. The slide that is dealing with the addressing the funding challenge, I think then it will make it a little bit of an answer. if you look at it on the face of it, that the funding model was compromised because we were unable to invoice, you would say, as you go back to the true picture being portrayed, it won't be reflected at the true picture, because invoicing and the funding model are separate from each other. The most of the findings of the AG we accepted. The explanations were given where explanations could be given with verifying with information that would verify what is being said, and we have taken that in point, and hence we have beefed up the governance structures to make sure that we follow up the reports. The internal audit is beefed up in such a way that we have periodic meetings wherein we highlight all these things that we need to do in order not to have repeat findings. The 500,000, it was on the consultants. Can go back to that report. Let me deal with the scoping as we're looking into the document. Yes, scoping, the Auditor General is seeing it as you are doing work in a department and you have not received the proclamation as yet. Wherever you call it, you are assessing, it is work that is being done. It's not covered by a proclamation. We have not received it yet, so we will deem it as a work that is not supposed to be done. It's irregular. So in order to avoid that, we have embarked on a process which I will let Paul to expand more on.
Thank you, Chair. I think maybe if we can give a background that usually when we receive allegation from, we call them client departments or from whistleblowers or whatever, we give sort of vague allegation, an allegation from the department with these irregularities in the supply chain management, whereby their procurement value per annum is more than a billion. So in order for us to motivate for a proclamation on specific allegation, we needed to do an exercise of assessment, which we used to call it the scoping. Now, we do admit that it's not within the boundaries of the law, and we want to comply with our legislative act. Now, we are partnering with the Auditor General in terms of saying, in some cases, we might lose some of their opinion to be able to point to the right direction in terms of them giving opinion on wasteful, unauthorized and irregular expenditure. If a department come to us with the view of us investigating, we might get their report, annual auditor's report for that financial year, so that we don't spend much time on the scoping and assessment exercise. We are able to address the shortcomings that have been identified within the Auditor General space. So it will cut down on the scoping and assessment exercise that we are. Also, we have enforced our data analytics division, whereby if a department refer a matter to us, before we refer to the Department of Justice for the motivation, we are able to take into the different database and be able to identify the red flags and use them to motivate for a proclamation in that regard. Thanks.
Chair, on that question of the, you know, when you're going to reach a mark of 500,000, this has been occasioned, I suspect, by us retaining consultants on a longer basis, and you find that the end result, we have paid more than 500,000 to the consultant or a group of consultants. With the new shift, it is not going to happen again, because once what do you call that process again? That process where you do your no, there's a name for it in terms of foreign language. I'm just forgetting it because I'm still a lawyer. I've not yet been inducted to be a forensic investigator. But there is a process that is embarked upon wherein you factor in various factors into a project, looking at how much it's going to cost you, how many people it's going to cost you, what skills would you need in order for you to get to a particular point, phase one, phase two, phase three. So once, at the beginning when you do your red flagging and you anticipate that it's going to last, say for instance, 6 months, and you're going to necessarily need, let's say in a housing, you're going to necessarily need architects to work on this project for more than 100 hours, where they charge maybe 1,500 per hour, and you find that the collective amount will be over that 500,000, the right processes will then be followed in terms of attracting bids and so forth. So it won't ever happen again, but it happens that way. And the other problem, I think, it was also by the retention of you contract the consultants and you never really get read after the project has begun. You find a certain space for them to work in there. Now, when it comes out as a one continuous payment to the one consultant. Yeah. Yes. And all the other comments are welcome, Chair. And if you would, we could have a list of the items that you have mentioned just at a later stage, so that we can make sure that in the next reporting, you'll be all smiles. Thank you.
Conclude this. You set yourself a target of 100 people who have assets of more than 5 million rands obtained unlawfully, and this is by April 2014. I'm asking this now because we're approaching the end of the 12th. 2 years left. Yes. So, how far are you with these 100 people? Identified them and waiting for them to get the 5 million rands first before you move in on them?
Well, it has been discussed that it looks like we want to meet that target by 2014. Luckily, I'm sitting with the Secretariat of the ACTT, and these cases are handled by a group of all of us. The last I checked, it was standing at 69, and the number was 69. It's matters that are already sitting in court, and there were other convictions also. I don't have the figures yet, but we've got quite a sizable, more than 20% of convictions, and it was sitting at 69 now people. But there has been a review of the definition now of the target, which Zona will expire on right now.
It has been engagement with the presidency, engagement with the ACTT and the ministry and everybody. I suppose it was linked to the delivery agreement. So it's a review in line with that. So it's not necessarily all the targets is going to be achieved what the SIU does. So what we can do is to submit a report to yourselves in terms of what we've submitted, which will show the number of cases and what stage and what assets are identified. I think it was part of what we've given to the presidency for the cabinet Lekota, showing progress. The inherent logic out of the debate, without necessarily moving the goalposts, is was the very same question of the feasibility of achieving those targets, considering that you are now dealing with people who have significant resources, who was going to use every trick in the book to slow down the process. So it's forcing the system, if we can call it that, to work better with itself, to sharpen its pencil so that you don't end up. But the difficulty still exists, but are you going to be able to achieve all of those targets by 2014? But there has been, I think, more than 100, they're calling them instances, where people have been looked at, but subsequently then how far they are in the process or they have appeared in court, that we can give you an outline.
One of some of my questions and comments about this
thank you, Chair. That concludes our report. We're deliberating on whether or not to take you through part two, but then it is already at your leisure. Road ahead, which is part answered by what we have been discussing here, which also will address this much against it.
Understand that today's deliberation will come in the light of in the manner in which we dealt with it. I felt at one stage that I should apologize to Mrs. Yati for being that well-known to consider the passing to the school that she wants.
Thank you.
And if you would some encouraging words, please step it up. Set it up so that we can say to people and they will receive the clips being Dr. Hamilton. So that's what people want to see. There's nothing worse than for the citizen being out there to just see that, well, so-and-so is just getting 2 minutes on the ground. And he stands in public and says, well, it's terrible. So we rely on the evidence. So leave it as encouraging that. Thank you.
My bag with you. When we have time, we just want to rush to the look. The look up. Mm-hmm. I want to rush to the look.
Were you talking to me or not?
Oh,
we're just saying that.
Oh, my goodness.